Welcome back to another episode of our brand new podcast, City Hall Pass, hosted by myself, the counsel to the mayor, Kapel Longani. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to provide you, the general public, with a unique window into the problem-solving process at the highest levels of our city government, and to be able to share insights into key decisions as told by the trailblazing leaders who made them. And now I want to introduce my two hosts today, two women who are truly brilliant and inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
I want to introduce you to our next guest, Secretary Jay Johnson. Jay Johnson has had a distinguished career, combining private law practice at the international law firm Paul Weiss and many senior-level public positions, including three Senate-confirmed presidential appointments. As many of you know, he served as Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama, as well as General Counsel to the Department of Defense and the Air Force. Secretary Johnson is also on the boards of Lockheed Martin, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Center for a New American Security. He also finds time to be a non-resident senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and has debated numerous times at both the Oxford and Cambridge unions in England. Secretary Johnson is also a regular commentator on national issues at every major national network, including CBS, NBC, MSNBC, and even Fox News. And he's published op-eds in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. The secretary was kind enough to speak to us about a lot of things, including his outlook on leadership and management, his thoughts on the recent presidential election, and he even shared some really interesting anecdotes about the Osama bin Laden operation and 9/11. And at the end, he proved to us that he indeed is a true New Yorker. We really hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we enjoyed talking to the secretary. I now want to welcome the former Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama, Secretary Jay Johnson. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us today on City Hall Pass.
My pleasure. Little known fact, I served for 7 hours and 32 minutes as Secretary of Homeland Security for President Trump, because on January 20, 2017, I was the designated survivor. I could not leave office until my successor was appointed and confirmed by the Senate. So I make a great trivia question. Who was Donald Trump's first Secretary of Homeland Security? In fact, who was his first cabinet officer? That was me.
Were you actually in the office when he was inaugurated?
No, I was at home, a permanent home in Montclair, New Jersey. It was not undisclosed. It was a disclosed location for the designated survivor that day.
And were you still making decisions until the last minute?
What to have for dinner? Yes. Yes. No, I was planning to leave office at exactly noon on January 20, get in my own car, drive up I-95 and the Jersey Turnpike to my home in Montclair, New Jersey, without Secret Service, and wake up the next morning a normal person. But it didn't turn out that way. For the second time while I was in office, I was asked to be the designated survivor. And on Inauguration Day, it's a fundamentally different exercise because everyone is leaving. And so somebody in the Obama administration had to stay on until my successor was appointed. And that's what I did. So I just came home a day early on January 19 after inspecting the security of the inaugural grounds and spent the day at home.
And for our audience that doesn't know, Mr. Secretary, who is the designated survivor?
There are 18, if I think I got my count right, people in the presidential line of succession, vice president, speaker, president pro tem of the Senate, and members of the cabinet in the order of the seniority of the department they lead. DHS was created in 2002. It is the newest cabinet level department. Therefore, I was the last person in the presidential line of succession, which surprised me actually, because I thought it just kept going into deputy secretaries, undersecretaries, until you got to the deputy assistant secretary of agriculture someplace. But no, it stopped with me. But in the presidential line of succession, I was asked, When you have everybody in the presidential line of succession in one place, you really shouldn't. So for the State of the Union address, for example, or the inauguration, when everyone in the presidential line of succession is invited to be there, one person in the presidential line of succession has to absent themselves to the undisclosed location in case of catastrophe. Many people would take comfort in knowing that there's a whole shadow government that is there in the undisclosed location in the event of a catastrophe, not just the one designated survivor of the presidency. So I did that January 2016, State of the Union, and then I was asked to do it again in January 2017 for the inauguration, except I just got to go home a day early.
Who asks you to be a designated survivor? Who makes that decision?
That's a good question. I suspect the president has to sign off on it, but the direction, the request, generally comes from the White House military office.
Why do you think President Obama turned to you to lead DHS?
I still wonder. I don't want to know how many people he asked first before he got to me. I had been general counsel of the Department of Defense for 4 years, sitting next to the Secretary of Defense, who leads the largest cabinet-level department of our government. I was present for a number of very significant national security decisions, required to make some really tough legal calls on some national security decisions. I was involved in President Obama's campaign for president in 2007, 2008, from the beginning. So I was a known commodity. I asked myself that very question when I got the phone call in August of 2013. Why me? I had never led an agency of 230,000 people or anything close to it. You know, we lawyers like to think we can do everything, but leadership is not a natural skill for a lawyer. Indeed, some of the attributes of a good lawyer could be lousy attributes for a good leader. And eventually came to the point of view that if the president thinks I can do the job, then maybe I should defer to that judgment.
Is he the one that calls you initially, or are there other people that talk to you and say, you know, Mr. Johnson, is this something you'd be interested in, or did you just get a call from the president?
The subject was initially broached over cocktails in Martha's Vineyard in August 2013, and then about 10 days later, I received a phone call from his chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, when I was on a business trip in Hong Kong, and he asked me directly if I would be willing to take the job on. I said, well, I have to think about it a little bit. Spoke to my wife, spoke to two people whose judgments I value greatly, my two former clients at DOD, Robert Gates and Leon Panetta. And then I said, yes.
Why did you have any doubts?
I'd been a lawyer my entire professional life. I'd been a private practitioner. I had been an assistant United States attorney. I had been general counsel of the Air Force, general counsel of the Department of Defense. But in my entire professional life, I had always had legal jobs. I'd never had a non-legal management job, let alone one running a cabinet department of 230,000 people with 22 components, specifically litigators like myself, are required to learn a lot about a particular subject in order to present a case, try a case, argue a case. We are required to learn as much about the subject matter as the client. Lawyers generally do not know how to defer, how to manage very large organizations. Yeah, sure, I've managed a trial team, but we generally don't know how to manage a very, very large organization, how to be a CEO. And the instinct to learn a lot about one thing can cost you the ability to pay attention to everything else in a very large organization. So that was an acquired skill.
In September, you spoke at Liberty University about leadership, and you listed 5 important traits that every leader should know. You said they should tell the truth, build consensus, be inclusive, never ask someone to do something you wouldn't do yourself, and the golden rule of treat others as you would have them treat you. What are some of the moments or people who have influenced you and turned you into the leader you are today?
I learned a lot from watching Robert Gates. I learned a lot from watching Leon Panetta. They were Secretary of Defense when I was General Counsel of Defense. They were very different people with very different management skills. Gates was very disciplined, a lot like Barack Obama, actually. Very disciplined, very orderly. He had some gatekeepers around him in the E-ring of the Pentagon. He was very careful about what he said. You could see the wheels turning when he spoke publicly on TV. Very careful in his selection of words. Very careful about who he repeated things to. Very careful about who he said things to and what he was being told. Leon Panetta was very different. He was more gregarious, outgoing, but had very good relationships with Congress and the press. When I was first asked to be Secretary of Homeland Security, I asked myself, okay, what leader that I know should I emulate? Ultimately, you should be, what I think I said in that speech at Liberty, the best version of yourself. Barack Obama did not ask me to lead the Department of Homeland Security to be Robert Gates or to be Leon Panetta. He asked me to be Jay Johnson. So I realized in a leadership position, there is no one right way to lead. Everyone has to be the best version of themselves.
Yeah, you're one of the few people in the world who can say they've managed almost 250,000 people at one time. From a leadership perspective, what are the most important lessons you learned in managing an organization of that size?
I think it's critical, first of all, that you always tell the truth. You deliver hard truths when necessary. Treat others as you would be treated. Never ask a subordinate to do something that you wouldn't do yourself. One of the things that I did when I was secretary that got a lot of praise, and I was determined to raise morale within DHS, because DHS is always in the bottom of the list in terms of morale in the federal government. And I was going to raise morale if it killed me. So one day I went out to BWI Airport and put on a TSA uniform. TSA is part of Homeland Security. And I started working the line, passing the bins, inspecting the carry-on and everything. And none of the passengers recognized me. They just grumbled at me like they always grumble at everybody else. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Have a nice flight. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah, give me back my belt. And the TSOs all loved it. They loved the fact that the boss was willing to be undercover boss and put on the uniform and the badge and work alongside them. Never ask someone to do something you wouldn't do yourself, which is why I could never have asked in the depths of any crisis on our southern border an immigration enforcement officer to take a child away from its mother. Just couldn't do that. Couldn't do it myself, and I couldn't ask someone from ICRO to do that.
Did you do that for all of your agencies? Did you go, for example, to ICE? Did you visit the
I border? Put on a customs uniform at a port. I think it was the port of Baltimore. I got on horseback on the Arizona-Mexico border. They found, I'm quite sure, the oldest, most sluggish horse anywhere in the Southwest for me to ride. Yeah, I tried to get around. But the most important thing is tell the truth, be straightforward, and don't be afraid to ask something of people. When I communicated to the public about the threats out there when I was Secretary of Homeland Security, my messages had basically three components to them without scaring people. My successor, John Kelly, who I admire and respect, said something that I disagreed with. He said at one point publicly, if you knew what I knew, you'd never get out of bed. There's no point saying something like that to the American public. There's no point to that. My public messaging, I tried to, one, say in as clear and as truthful a fashion as possible, here's the current threat, component two to the message. Here's what your government is doing about it. And component three, what you, the public, should do or not do after a terrorist attack, for example. This happened. We think it was caused by XYZ terrorist organization. Here are the 10 things your government is doing about this. And then last but not least, we encourage the public to be vigilant, to be aware. If you see something, say something, but continue to participate in public events, go to public spaces, you know, enjoy your holiday weekend. So my messages tended to have those three components to it and not just simply scare people. And I believe that the public generally expects those things of their leadership. Tell us what our government is doing about this and tell us what we should or should not do to support the effort. And most people accept that when you tell them the truth.
Is there anything memorable about your first day as DHS secretary?
I was sworn into office on December 23, 2013. I started the way I ended at my home in Montclair. It was after Senate confirmation. It was rather sudden. And I took the oath administered by the chief judge of the United States District Court of the Southern District, who happens to be a close friend of mine, Colleen McMahon, in my living room of my house, in front of my family, the Christmas tree, and the dog. That was my first day. My last day was also in Montclair. That was the night of the inauguration. And I was having dinner with my wife and my detail leader in the Secret Service. When he got the word that Kelly had been confirmed and I was relieved, I said to my detail leader, okay, I'm going to get up from this restaurant and I'm going to walk out that door. And for the first time in 3 years, you're not going to follow me. And it was wonderful. I went for a walk in the dark all by myself. When I was sworn in, what I remember most about that moment was, and I suspect as we speak, the president-elect is probably going through the same emotional roller coaster. There's the high of getting appointed, confirmed, sworn in. And then within a moment, you say, okay, I've got some serious responsibilities I got to now go address. I got to get to work.
We'll be right back with more City Hall Pass. But in the meantime, have you signed up for Notify NYC? Notify NYC is the city's dedicated emergency public communications program. Notify NYC staff operate 24/7 and constantly monitor emergency activity in the New York City metropolitan area. Alerts are issued for critical incidents involving your safety or the safety of others, including missing person alerts, public health notifications, weather emergencies, mass transit disruptions, and more. To sign up, visit nyc.gov/notifyNYC and text COVID to 692-692 to receive COVID-19 specific updates. Thanks for listening.
Mr. Secretary, what is the greatest national security threat facing the United States right now?
Obviously, as we speak, the greatest immediate threat is COVID-19. Any one thing that can kill over 200,000 Americans in the period of 8 months must be considered a national security crisis. So that's front and center. Longer term, the greatest national security crisis we face is climate change, global warming. Because of global warming and because we as a nation and as a global community are failing to address it, that makes it a national security challenge. Specifically, and this is what I was focused on in office, severe weather events and the effect they have on aging infrastructure, like our tunnels, our bridges, our piers, and so forth. That is the greatest long-term national security threat we face. There are other threats, obviously. There's the threat of offensive cyber attacks on our nation, on our critical infrastructure. There are a number of threats, but those are the two that come to mind, immediate and long-term, and I hope that the new administration will address both of them with energy and determination.
If you had been DHS Secretary during the COVID era, what would have been your first move when you found out, let's say in January, February, that this was going to be a significant issue?
It's easy to be an armchair quarterback from the comfort of private life. I will say that had COVID happened on our watch, I'm quite sure there would have been a lot of criticism to go around. Republicans would have been demanding hearings and generally making our life miserable. And no government in this circumstance would be immune from some level of criticism. This is an unprecedented once in a century event, though it was not unanticipated. After the experience of Ebola in 2014, I'm quite sure that in the first signs of COVID, we would have viewed this first and foremost as an extraterritorial threat, much like the current administration did, though they were slow to act, because that's how we viewed Ebola. So we would have viewed it as an issue, as a matter of travel restrictions, first and foremost. I think I can say that though the public health authority to quarantine, to require people to stay away from work, to close businesses, close restaurants, resides at the state and local level in this country, given our federalist structure, President Obama would have been very vigilant and demanding and used his soapbox and his moral authority to demand that people physically distance, wear a mask, exercise good hygiene, and so forth. And then, of course, the principal role of the federal government in a crisis like this is allocating resources through the authority of the Defense Production Act and other things. I think it's fair to say we would have been more aggressive about asserting the authorities available to us to allocate resources and make sure things like masks, PPE, ventilators get into the right hands at the right time.
Mr. Secretary, in my last job as a lawyer, on the Committee for Oversight and Government Reform, where I served as counsel to the late, great Elijah Cummings, we spent a lot of time investigating FEMA's response to natural disasters. And as our audience knows, FEMA is the nation's first responder when it comes to natural disasters. Since DHS oversaw FEMA, what did you learn in managing FEMA in terms of best practices for overseeing a crisis?
I had the advantage of serving with a really terrific leader of FEMA, Craig Fugate. Craig Fugate was a national asset. I didn't mind that the president went directly to Craig Fugate in times of disasters because Craig Fugate was a real star. FEMA, under his leadership, really has come a long way since the days of Katrina. FEMA now is probably the best federal agency there is at deploying, allocating resources very quickly. They're a very mission-oriented agency now. They're not lethargic. They're not sluggish. FEMA knows how to get meals out, get bottled water out, to communicate. The U.S. Army could take lessons from FEMA under proper leadership. It's a really agile federal public agency. You know, there are these polls, and I'm speaking from a frame of reference of about 5 years ago, there are these polls that show how Americans trust their government, do the right thing less and less. You know, in the days of Eisenhower, it was in the 70s. Now it's supposedly down in the 20s. But if you poll people mission by mission, what do you trust the federal government to do best? At least 5 years ago, disaster response was still way up there. FEMA was one of the components of DHS that did not need a whole lot of oversight. My first impulse after a national disaster was, I got to go there. And Craig would always tell me, let's wait a couple days, let the dust settle. And when you show up, there's going to be a lot of security and everything. Give them time to get organized and then show up. And a test of the confidence people have, or at least had, in disaster response was when I'd show up at the scene of a tornado or a flood or a hurricane, every politician in the state would want to be there with me, Republican or Democrat. The mayor, the governor, the representatives in the House, the two senators, the state legislatures, the county judge, they'd all want to be in the photo with me because they knew when Homeland Security and FEMA showed up, this was something people would look to for leadership.
Do you think FEMA should have played a bigger role in the COVID response?
Yes, I do. I think FEMA should have been the centerpiece of the COVID response from day one. Didn't work out that way.
So, you know, you just mentioned confidence in disaster response. We've had really a front seat to COVID-19. We've been working day in and day out. And there are some things we just know now. We know wearing masks work. We know social distancing works. But I haven't seen that same message at the federal level. Do you still have the same confidence in disaster response that you had?
What is so tragic about where we are with COVID right now, we are the nation with the mightiest public healthcare apparatus and capability that has had the poorest public healthcare response in the world. By mid-April, when we began in this area, in the New York, New Jersey area, to flatten the curve, we knew what it took to slow the spread of this virus. Physical distancing, encouraging people to stay home, stay off the streets, wear a mask, good hygiene. We knew what it took to flatten the curve. By mid-April, all people needed to do was to be disciplined and hang in there. Yet, as a nation, our leadership has allowed and indeed encouraged the public to lower their guard, get sloppy in the face of a visible enemy, and to minimize the risk. So we are now, after the initial surge in the spring, on our second resurgence. There was the resurgence in July in the Southeast, and then there was the resurgence more recently in the Northern Midwest, and now it's starting to spread again here in the Northeast. But the real disaster is that by mid-April, we knew what it took to fix this, to address this, and we've just failed to do it throughout the country. I give our leaders here in the Northeast a lot of credit because we got hit with this first, and our leaders stepped up, addressed it, and we turned the corner by mid-April.
Do you think we should have been more aggressive in terms of restricting international travel? I know one of the things that has been talked about not only in the Northeast, but throughout the country, is why the federal government has not taken a more active role in restricting both domestic and international travel.
The ironies abound. This administration, their signature issue was restricting immigration, restricting entry into this country. Yet, when the time came to actually do that in the face of a lethal pandemic, failed to act aggressively. And indeed, most other nations on earth now restrict us from going to them because of our response to COVID. How ironic is that? But my armchair assessment from where I sit, and I know from personal experience, that the gulf between what somebody inside government knows and what somebody who's part of the public knows can be vast. But my impression is that we were not going to prevent the entry of COVID-19 into this country simply through travel restrictions, because the travel restrictions would have had to legally would have been full of exceptions, like the one from China on January 31st. We were not going to be able to prevent the entry of COVID to our shores. But once it was here, there were things that we can do, did do, could have done to prevent its spread or limit its spread to manageable levels.
Mr. Secretary, as President-elect Biden puts together, you know, his transition team and also his COVID-19 response task force, if you had an opportunity to provide them some advice on how to handle COVID now, particularly with the, you know, resurgence of the pandemic or of the virus, what is the number one thing you would say to them?
Well, unfortunately, it's counseling a baseball team in the top of the ninth inning how to come from behind when you're down 10 runs. But it's not over. It's not impossible. First and foremost, we have to change the public's attitude toward COVID. Millions and millions of people in this country have been told it's not serious. It's not as bad as the flu. It's not lethal. The only reason there are so many cases is because there's so many tests, that young people are somehow immune. It's a deprivation of your civil liberties and so forth. We have to change the national mood, first and foremost. We have to marshal efforts, a national imperative to find a vaccine. And once a vaccine is found, figure out a way to distribute it in vast quantities to the American people. So there's a lot to do.
We'll be right back with more from our conversation with Secretary Jay Johnson. But I want to take a second to remind our listeners to get tested for COVID-19. And remember, tests are free. Text COVID-TEST to 85548 or visit nyc.gov/COVID-TEST to find a convenient site near you. Back to you, Kate.
In 2000, my dad spent some time in Afghanistan working on a documentary called Afghanistan Revealed for National Geographic. They were embedded with Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was a leader fighting against the Taliban. As you, I'm sure, know, Massoud was very friendly towards Westerners and always welcomed the media to shed light on the resistance. And he actually had warned about a potential attack. On September 10th, my dad received a call that Massoud had been assassinated the previous day by individuals claiming to be a Belgian camera crew. And the bomb was embedded either in the camera or on the belt of one of the cameramen. The next day, 9/11 occurred. And many believe that Osama bin Laden ordered Massoud's assassination to ensure the Taliban would cooperate in Afghanistan. My family, like so many, were devastated by 9/11, but I have very strong memories of that previous day as well. How significant was 9/11 in terms of your career path?
9/11 changed my life. I was right here in Manhattan on 9/11/01, which was my 44th birthday. I was at my law firm, the same firm I'm with now, Paul Weiss, at 6th Avenue and 51st. I recall it was a gorgeous, beautiful day, crisp blue sky, just like today. At 8:46 or 8:48 a.m., I looked out the window and saw the black smoke billowing out of the World Trade Center. And I still remember the contrast with the deep, clear blue sky. It changed my life. As a result of that, I rededicated myself to returning to national security. I had been general counsel of the Air Force 9 months before in the Bill Clinton administration. And got a chance 7 years later to return to national security and as general counsel of the Department of Defense, where I made a number of legal judgments on counterterrorism operations that I think made our nation safer.
And as a national security expert and a New Yorker, what were the most important lessons you learned from 9/11?
that reality and everything you assume about reality can change in an instant. From a national security point of view, there are major lessons learned about connecting dots. But like other events in national security subsequent to that, what we know to be the norm can be snatched away in an instant. When I saw the towers collapse, it was one of the very few moments in my life when my brain could not believe what my eyes were seeing, because those two towers had been part of the fixture of New York City for so long. When they collapsed and there was this big cloud of smoke, I kept believing that the first tower was going to emerge. Then it was going to be there, but it was gone. It changed my life. It changed a lot of people's lives. I still remember. It's 19 years from now, but I'll never forget it. One of the interesting things about the experience, which many of you may have also recalled, is on that day, time seemed to move very slowly. By the time I went home, got in my car and drove home to New Jersey at 3:30 in the afternoon, it felt like a week had passed from 8 hours earlier when I drove in to work. I remember crossing the George Washington Bridge. All the traffic was going outbound. No traffic was allowed to come inbound that day. I'd never seen that before on the George Washington Bridge. Fighter jets in the sky. I had a similar sensation on May 1st, 2011, the day we got bin Laden. I was in the command center of the Pentagon in the basement, and because I knew I was taking notes of history, I was taking notes of every single thing that I saw and heard from the team of special forces that went into Pakistan that day. And it seemed like time moved very slowly. By the time we all left at, I guess, 7 o'clock, it felt like it had been a week down in the basement of the command center.
And for those unfamiliar, what was your role during the bin Laden operation?
According to public published reports in the New York Times and elsewhere, I gave the legal sign off. I developed the legal justification for going into Pakistan to get bin Laden without the Pakistani government's knowledge and consent.
Was that analysis difficult?
There are three international law bases for going into another nation militarily. One, with host nation consent. Two, when authorized by a UN Security Council resolution. Or three, and this is the most controversial, as an act of self-defense when the host nation is unwilling or unable to address the threat itself. And according to published reports, that was the international legal basis for our special forces going to Pakistan to get bin Laden.
Since 9/11, New York City and the country has developed a greater sense of being on high alert and certainly be more prepared for terrorism. In 2016, it was actually my first week working at City Hall, and during your tenure as DHS Secretary, you came to New York City after a pressure cooker bomb exploding in Chelsea. It was actually where my husband and I were living at the time, and I remember hearing the explosion as we were walking back from Whole Foods, and we thought, did scaffolding just collapse? What just happened? And we knew it was something different because the dogs in the neighborhood were just acting in such a bizarre manner that clearly led to this just wasn't something typical. Can you tell us what your first thoughts were about hearing that a bomb had gone off in Manhattan?
One, we were remarkably lucky. It could have been much worse. The pressure cooker bomb that went off on West 23rd Street did not kill anyone. There was a second, as you recall, that did not detonate. The lady that called it in because she remembered seeing in the subways the signs, if you see something, say something. Apparently somebody previously had discovered the thing and took the suitcase and left the pressure cooker bomb, but we were remarkably lucky. There was an attempted detonation in 2017 in the subway tunnel between 7th and 8th Avenue, right after Thanksgiving, as I recall. The bomb didn't detonate, or it detonated, but it was kind of a dud. That's where I used to commute every day. I used to walk right through that tunnel at that exact moment. Except that day, I chose to walk above ground and not below ground. So as a private citizen, sometimes I lapse back into Homeland Security mode. I have that impulse still. So the next day, I decided to, instead of walking above ground, walk below ground, past the exact site at the exact time. And sure enough, there was a camera crew and they recognized me. And I said, as New Yorkers, we're courageous, we're brave, we don't run and hide. Fortunately, this did not detonate, and I encourage New Yorkers to continue to do what they've been doing.
Mr. Secretary, the election proved that we are a country that continues to be closely divided. In your view, what is it going to take to unify us?
That's a good question. That could be the question about American politics right now. We are a nation bitterly divided. I believe that the media and the pollsters have consistently underestimated the level of support that Donald Trump has in this country. It is somewhere between, I mean, depending on how you count, his really, really determined base could be as high as 30, 35% of the American public. 47, 48% of the American public voted for him this last time around. He got 71 million votes. We are a nation bitterly divided. I believe that close elections like this one will be the new norm for a while. No more landslides for a while, because we are a nation bitterly divided. One of the reasons we are a nation bitterly divided is because we don't talk to each other enough. In my private life, I have made a point of not just talking to people who I know already agree with me. So you quoted the convocation address I gave on 9/11 this year at Liberty University. The Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, the cradle of Southern Christian conservatism. I was invited to go there, and I accepted the invitation to talk about the importance of character and morality in leadership because I thought it would resonate with that audience, and I think it did. I could have easily given that speech at Columbia, at NYU, to the American Constitution Society. But I wanted to give that speech. I was waiting to give that speech at a venue like Liberty, and I got the invitation and I did it. Last week, as the press was getting close to announcing for Biden, I remember turning on MSNBC, and there's Steve Kornacki, their bean counter, going through the math with the latest returns. Biden is getting closer in Pennsylvania, and he's doing the math. And then I turned to Fox, and Fox at that moment was really dark, conspiracy theories about how the election was being stolen. And I go on Fox once in a while, and it was clear, just flipping back and forth, it's two alternate realities at work, two alternate universes at work. So I emailed people at Fox and I said, put me on. I want to be on Fox today. Put me on today. And they put me on with Neil Cavuto. And I said that we are a nation bitterly divided, but all Americans should accept and respect the result. I've had bitter disappointments in my life based on the outcome of an election. I talked about 1980, I talked about 2000, I talked about 2016, but we all as Americans must accept and respect the result. That is the price of the democracy we have. And if you don't like the result, you get another opportunity in 4 years to change it. I got the usual array of hate mail from when I go on Fox. You know, there's some really angry people out there who don't like to see a Democrat in Fox. I suppose it's the same with MSNBC and Republicans, I don't know. But I felt it was important to try to bridge that gap and talk to people who I know are not already inclined to agree with me.
Despite the country being bitterly divided, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope is that we are a resilient nation. I believe in the pendulum theory of American politics, where Americans try one thing and then every 4 or 8 years they want something very different in their politics and who they elect as a leader. And we're seeing that right now. We saw that last week. A majority of the Electoral College, at least, tried Donald Trump in 2016, and we've now determined to try something very different. Many people will view this as sort of a return to normalcy election. But that's the beauty of our democracy. Every 4 years, we have a chance to change course, and we've done that.
Mr. Secretary, our current boss, the mayor of New York City, oversees a city that is a symbolic capital of the free world. You had a great relationship with the mayor during your tenure as DHS secretary and afterwards, too. Can you tell us a little bit more about what your relationship with him is like?
One of the things I like about Bill de Blasio is, unlike other mayors, other elected officials I've encountered, he is not afraid to engage intellectually on a topic and think through a problem. I have sat in his office discussing an issue and thinking through very methodically and logically together how we could come to common ground and solve the problem. And so I have appreciated that about him while he was in office and while I was in office, and we have remained friends since then.
So I'm about to introduce a new game I call Q and J. I'll provide you with two words, and you just pick one. It's like a this or that.
This or that.
It's a choice.
It's a choice. But what do I prefer?
Ham or turkey?
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right.
Okay. So New York or New Jersey?
This is really hard.
Final answer.
I live in New Jersey. At the risk of getting myself into some trouble, I consider myself a New Yorker.
Dentist or lawyer?
You're really trying to get me in trouble. My wife's a dentist. I'm a lawyer. Okay. Because of dentistry, I can sit here and talk to you. How's that?
Great. DOD or DHS?
DHS. How can I not say DHS?
Jay Carney or Jay-Z?
Jay-Z.
Tuscany or Wake Island?
She's done her research. Tuscany.
Okay, last question. Designated Survivor or 24?
24.
Both Kiefer Sutherland shows?
Well, when you say 24 to me, I think Willie Mays, so I got to say 24.
And that concludes probably the final episode of Q and J.
Secretary, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure.
I want to thank Secretary Johnson again for taking the time to join us on City Hall Pass. I think this conversation proved again why Secretary Johnson's counsel is sought by some of our most esteemed leaders. We really hope you enjoyed the conversation and hope to have you back again next week for another new episode of City Hall Pass. Thanks so much for listening, New York.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City, with support from the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Special thanks to our executive producer, Stathi, and a big thank you to Karen, Roland, Jenna, and Andrew from the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. We couldn't do this without you.